We're going to begin right away because, as you know, we're being pressed by the Skylab science pilots. And we're going to try and break this up just a little before 6 o'clock so we can start with that. We have some of the more distinguished scientists from the conference to give you some summaries of what's going on, and we'll give you time to ask any questions you might like to ask. We'll begin with Dr. Robert M. Walker of Washington University of St. Louis.
I really think that's not appropriate because I want to go from the sort of moon out to the moon-space interface, and I think it might be better to start off with the moon as a whole. Okay.
All right. Dr. Gass, would you like to begin? Or Dr. Wasserberg, I know you're in a hurry. Would you? All right.
Well, I hadn't had much time to think about this. I think that going into the conference, there were a number of questions which were clear as questions, and it wasn't clear how many answers there are going to be to some of those. I think some of those questions are still questions. One of the questions which I'll leave as a question is, you know, what actually happened on the moon around 3.9 billion years ago? I think this cataclysm that Dr. Wasserberg mentioned is somewhat of a mystery. I mean, and that's the thing I like to emphasize, that it is a mystery. There are hypotheses as to how many worlds were in collision at that time, but it still is not clear what really happened. And I think the reason for that not being clear, or the reason why it's so difficult for us to make that clear, is that we have really very, very little understanding of what happens during a major impact and how rocks get metamorphosed, or how a rock that goes through a major impact should look or might look. We have no criteria. There's nobody that I can hand a rock to, or you can hand a rock to and say, here's a rock. Tell me whether this rock was a lava flow that came out and cooled slowly on the surface of the moon, or whether this rock was a result of some major impact. That is something that's going to have to be looked at rather carefully. Another summary statement, which I think can be reemphasized, is that it's very clear now when you look at the 17 rocks, something that began to come out of the 16 rocks, is that the simple idea that the islands were made of one kind of rock, and that is an anorthosite rich in plagioclase, is a drastic oversimplification, and maybe it's worse than that. If you heard Dr. Rose's talk and Dr. Finney's talk this afternoon, I think you didn't hear very much about anorthosites in the 17th site. And that's because there apparently weren't very many there. Even if we just restrict ourselves to North Massif and South Massif and the light-colored rocks, there are, in fact, rocks that look more like, and I emphasize look more like at this stage, we can't be sure, some type of volcanic rock. And by volcanic rock, I have an argument with some of my colleagues. I say you can't tell whether something's a volcanic rock by looking at its chemistry. But intuitively, I would argue that well over half of the rocks that were returned from the 17th site from our present inventory, and really also for the 16th site, this is true, are not anorthositic rocks, but that these rocks are ultimately some type of lava flow that came out on the surface. There's a great deal of controversy about this particular point. But the picture that one gets of the highlands is rather different than what one takes as the interpretation of these rocks. One is that the highland was some primitive, consisted of a primitive crust, which different people describe in different ways, which consisted of a mixture of different rock types, some of them being anorthosite, some of them being basalts, uranium-rich rocks of different compositions. The other picture is that the highland consists of an original crust which may have been largely anorthosite, on the surface of which, at some later time being perhaps 100 or 300 million years after the crust was formed, lava flows came up, much in the same way as the Mare basalt lava flows came up, still later, covered these, but that we don't see these lava flows today because they've been so badly smashed up by the impacts that were very frequent in the early history of the moon, that we have to sort of feel our way through the rocks and make a lot of guesses as to what was there. We don't see the evidence for these like we do for the Mare basalts. Finally, let me say something about the Orange Saw. We had a very interesting session this afternoon, which was somewhat strenuous for some of the speakers, I think. But I think when we see all these facts about the Orange Soil compressed into, you know, 90 minutes or so, this less than 90 minutes of discussion, not everybody agreed on that this afternoon, but there were a number of independent suggestions, such as a slow cooling rate, which was measured by studying the differential thermal properties of the glass, the low metallic iron content of the soil, which point to its having a different origin from all other glass. It's completely homogeneous chemistry. I think some of the speakers did not appreciate that you cannot make this orange soil from the Mare basalts because it has a totally different chemical composition. So that the orange soil is something which may point to a particular type of volcanic activity 3.8 billion years ago rather than very recently.
Do you have a preference? Would you prefer to have questions right away, or would you rather wait and hear each of the statements? All right, fine. Dr. Wassenberg, would you like to follow that?
No. I really don't know the precise purpose for which we're here. I have some confusion as to what it is that you want to hear as sort of a summary of the conference, or... pretty hard to do, that type of phenomenon.
Well, it may be found other places, but the difference between it and other glasses will be the same difference as we find at this site, is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay, yeah. I think the exciting thing about the meeting is that while there are and always will be considerable differences of opinion, some first-order things seem very real. And a simple fact... if I may take the so-called cataclysm, is that the cataclysm or the termination of the cataclysm really was that any notion that we had that the bombardment history of the moon was moderated so that we would always be able to look through it back to early and earlier parts of lunar history, and it's a far more complex event in which data by several workers clearly shows us that pieces of earlier lunar crust are available, but are absolutely fouled up, and we have to learn how to read that record. The other thing, which perhaps is something, is that the nature of the Highland rocks have got to be thought of, as Dr. Gass said, and that any desire for oversimplifying them has got to be given up in favor of recognizing a basically complex terrain, which are mixtures of hot welded objects tumbled together, and which we have to use as a clue to the earlier lunar history. The cold highlands versus the hot, some hot Mare sites, I think is really not true, and I think the new data and the reevaluation of older data has shown that's not the case. The other thing which is very exciting to me is something perhaps that Dr. Silver will comment on, that is the clear evidence of transport mechanisms which are bringing material up that we would not have guessed at all in their intensity. And we are now getting a look at that with the Apollo 17 materials. And I think that in general, there is a fairly coherent picture of lunar evolution from a heavy bombardment history which ended with a heavy enough bombardment history so that the last curtain was so thick it's hard to see through, but still letting us see evidence of the early formation of the lunar crust, followed by Mare flooding, is one which we just, which then terminated very sharply in that the young rocks are absent. I think those first order things are now answered, and answered in a fashion that we could never have done without the Apollo 17 mission.
Dr. Silver, would you like to continue that?
Sure, I might not be redundant since I didn't hear Paul's earlier remarks.
Why don't you go ahead?
Why don't you wipe me out, Paul, if you've already said it? Okay. I'm excited about this meeting too because, first of all, what I think Dr. Wassenberg was referring to The appearance, for example, of in a sample of orange soil analyzed by Dr. Tatsumoto and his group, of an unusual isotopic composition of lead, one that is highly enriched in lead-204. The significance of lead-204 is that it has always been for us an indicator of the abundance of residual primordial lead in lunar materials, and most of the materials returned from previous missions have been strikingly depleted in that particular isotope, suggesting a very profound process of separation of the volatile elements from the refractory elements. However, we have found some evidence of surficial concentration of 204. We've always been struggling with the problem of what is terrestrial contamination and what is the unadulterated lunar sample. However, on this mission, by a combination of hard work and good luck, we probably have the cleanest handling that we've ever had, and we found the highest concentrations of lead-204. And we find it in a material which is, and in, at a level which is pretty difficult to be ambiguous about. There is a lot of lead-204 in that orange soil. And that says that somewhere in the lunar system, there is a region from which that orange soil was derived, which has not passed through the same fundamental fractionation of the volatile elements from the refractory elements. It may have done it to some degree, but to a very different degree, a much lesser degree than we're knowing now. Now, that's not the first sign we've had. Similar evidence was also suggested by work of Dr. Tatsumoto's group on the 16 rock, the famous rusty rock. In that rock, Dr. Tatsumoto found an enormous enrichment of lead compared to any other lunar samples that we've had, with one unique exception, and that's Funny Rock 12013. That's that famous little chip that we did so much work on, or Dr. Wasserberg's group did so much work on. And, well, that didn't have that much lead, Jerry.
Right ratio.
Okay, same ratios, but not that concentration. Anyway, that rock, Dr. Tatsumoto reported as having 14 parts per million of lead, but it was lead with a difference. It was lead which had very little 204, and a great deal of that special kind of radiogenic lead, which we've learned to recognize as typical of the lunar surface environment. There has been a process operating in the history of that part of the crust which produced that rock, 66095, which has concentrated lead extraordinarily, and then independently, other workers, particularly the group from the University of Chicago, have reported that other volatile elements are extremely enriched in that rock. Now, this says that there are transport and concentration processes operating either on the surface of the moon or from the interior of the moon to the surface of the moon, which are quite different both in direction and in magnitude from what we'd previously anticipated. And the moon is sort of developing a much greater variety of characteristics than the initial model was. We're just getting into the stages on a preliminary basis. I might say that work by Reed and his group from Chicago have shown that the orange soil, which is an enigma, because it's depleted in this and enriched in that, we can't explain why it's depleted in so much of the gas constituents, and at the same time peculiarly enriched in zinc, copper, lead, chlorine, bromine, iodine, which were, we would have thought these would have moved out. And they are uniquely tagged, at least in the case of the lead, by special isotopic properties that say that they don't come from any external systems, that is, non-lunar systems that we are familiar with. So we're getting a look at a new variety of chemical behavior in the moon, and that's one of the most exciting things for us, and it's one of the things that I think we can look forward to learning a lot more about from 17 and 16 samples as we develop this picture. Okay?
Dr. Haskin, would you care to comment on the preliminary findings from the earliest allocation?
Well, I think many of the points have been covered. This had to do mainly with the orange soil. I get rather ambiguous readings myself. Many of the chemical data would suggest to me that perhaps some kind of volcanic action has taken place, yet the bulk composition, as pointed out, is not quite like one would expect for volcanic materials, and many of the other petrographic characteristics seem to be contrary to a volcanic origin as inferred from terrestrial volcanics. I guess
the main thing that I feel at this point, the other principal points of the science having been touched on already by the other speakers, is that
particularly the back side
and the top side
and its upside.
Dr. Strangway, would you like to make some comments on the geophysics?
Well, I find myself sort of stunned after 4 days of sitting listening to papers. There's so much going on and so much happened, I'm not sure I can give you any kind of a real decent summary. I think I'd like to address perhaps two problems. Problem number one is that which the geophysics is contributing to the structure in the site at Torres Litoral. There were three traverse experiments carried, which were reported on this morning, the active seismic, the surface electrical properties, and the traverse gravimeter. Traverse gravimeter, unfortunately, wasn't represented by the speaker, but his results are in the public domain. And basically, I think those three experiments have made us rethink what the structure is in that vicinity. When we went, I think we had the idea there was going to be rather a shallow superficial layer of flows, of mantle of some kind, and then right underneath it we were going to grade into the old Highland materials. All three of those experiments are giving rather a consistent picture. There's a surface layer of 20 to 50 meters of perhaps rubble and regolith. There's a kind of a broken up rock layer perhaps that goes down to 200 or 300 meters, and then they all suggest that there's somewhere in the range of 1 to 2 kilometers probably of basaltic flows. So this means that the flow material is really quite thick in the valley at Torres Litoral. And I think this was kind of a surprise to a lot of people, as I think Bill Mulberger pointed out in his review of the structure this morning. It means that there's more extensive faulting, I think, and greater displacements than had been previously thought. So I think the geophysics is fitting into a picture of the local geology, if you like, or the geological structure at the Apollo 17 site. Then the other thing, which I think has been very exciting, it's kind of weaved through the whole thing, and you've heard about several people mention it already, but I think we're beginning to find that the geophysical data and the other models of the evolution of the moon and its kind of its history, I think we can start to rationalize these things. I think the seismic structure, which I know has been reported before, but the finding of the core and the fact that that's probably recent deep heating, the facts of the magnetic fields, which we can now think we can reconcile with a hot outside, cold inside moon, which is what so many of the people at this table are wanting. I think we're finding that there's a lot of rethinking of from the geophysicist's point of view as to how the moon has evolved, and I think our models are starting to have a kind of a consistency to them. They're by no means unique, and it'll be a long time before they are, but I think that that's been one of the exciting things to me of the conference, is that so many individual pieces of data have come to bear on Jerry Wasserberg's cataclysm, if you like, and hot outside, cold inside, eventually cooling off on the outside and warming up slowly on the inside. And I think there's a lot of different lines of evidence have come to bear on that. I could go on and on about all the geophysical experiments, but I think a lot of you have heard about these before, and some of these have been reported as they come along, so perhaps I'll quit there and wait for questions till when the question period comes up.
Can I add something you forgot, maybe out of modesty? That the magnetic field issue, which you discussed before, actually was to me one of the more exciting things that was talked about in the geophysical ideas, and much more than local geological structure. I think the problem of early magnetization, which you proposed or spoke about at any rate Monday, I think that's actually worth thinking about, Dave.
Well, I already told some of these people about that on Monday, so. And we'd be glad to answer questions on it.
Dr. Walker, would you like to talk about moon-space interface?
Yeah, and at the end of this, I'll get to the point of Dr. Strangway's magnetic model and show, in fact, the interaction between seemingly unrelated areas. Yeah, I'd like to switch mental gears, and I'm shifting down. Okay. Well, you people have been so kind of concerned with a minor planet. I'm about to treat the cosmos, so maybe we're going up. Now, I want to address the general question briefly. Okay, and I don't think there are any startling things that we've learned in this particular meeting. There are certainly great advances. Well, on the one hand, you have the impacts, of course, that were talked about here, and there you're learning something about the amount of material that's floating around in the solar system early in the game. One of the things, of course, that came out of the Apollo 16 site was the timing of major impacts that are at this end of the time spectrum, namely South Ray Crater, this very bright red crater that dominated the Apollo 16 site, was shown to be only a couple of million years old, whereas North Ray, which looked older on the photograph, in fact turns out to be older, to be about 40, perhaps 50 million years old. And that allows you to, of course, look at the dynamics in the process of change because of infalling material early in the solar system with the Great Basins and recently in the solar system with these more recent impacts and even down to the level of interplanetary dust. The pit counters are actually in agreement now. The pit counters are people who look at rocks and look at zap pits, okay, and try to estimate the fluxes of interplanetary dust. And these numbers for the first time are really coming together to give us really firm numbers now on the recent flux of interplanetary dust. And that's a problem that's been a problem for many, many years. Another theme I'd like to touch, is it's already been touched on by Strangway, is the very great role of surface experiments and also of orbital experiments and the interplay between these kinds of experiments and the kinds of experiments you can do with the rocks themselves. Let me try to make this liaison in the following way. You are making measurements now with mass spectrometers on board the on the actual surface of the moon and with a device called the superthermal ion detector of the current lunar atmosphere and how it changes as the sun warms up during the day and cools down during the night. Perhaps one window, that these are modern day measurements of a lunar atmosphere that's vastly more tenuous than the Earth's atmosphere. There's evidence in the rocks of ancient atmospheres. That's not the only interpretation, but one such atmosphere, and this was announced last year, and there's increasing evidence of the ubiquity of the phenomena this year, the existence of certain gas isotopes from the decay of elements that are now extinct but were prevalent at the beginning of the solar system. And these extinct isotope studies, which may be linked to an ancient lunar atmosphere, may be one window that you have on the very early history that is, in fact, so cloudy. One of the themes that I've been playing right from the beginning is the measurement of radiations from outside that hit the moon and are registered there. These radiations range from the solar wind. This is a general flux of particles, enormous in number, really, about 1 kilovolt per nucleon, capable of penetrating about a millionth of an inch that the sun puts out all the time. There are occasional violent storms on the sun, as you know, so-called solar flares. There was one that was widely publicized in August. And then there are the galactic cosmic rays that come in from outside the solar system altogether. On the Apollo missions, and on this particular Apollo missions, there have been experiments flown that have contributed new and quite startling information on the properties of some of these particles. For example, one inadvertent detector that was flown was a piece of glass that was recovered on the Apollo 12 mission from the Surveyor camera, and that showed an apparent enhancement of particles, heavy particles from the sun in solar flare events. That is, the number of heavy particles that came in from the sun on a solar flare were far in excess of those you would expect relative to, say, oxygen based on the photospheric abundances. That's a phenomenon that is confirmed as a consequence of subsequent flights, including the latest Apollo mission in which there was a detector aboard. And it also turns out that the sun always emits, even when it's supposedly quiet, as it was during the Apollo 17 mission, a flux of very low energy, very heavy particles. And that's something that was not expected and is a discovery. And these are enhanced in these heavy elements. Their character, in some sense, was not different. Whether they were more intense or not, we don't know. That links the question of a permanent magnetic field. If there were magnetic fields of the intensity that Dr. Strangway would like 4 billion years ago, they would probably have interacted with these ancient solar particles and have modified the number that could have reached the surface. And so far, as that record is preserved in lunar breccias, and it's pretty well preserved in some of them, we don't see any such effect, and therefore we are somewhat dubious about this wonderful idea. It's a good idea, but I'm dubious.
I'll cut
I'll
you,
stop
Bob.
There. I would say, the exploration phase may be over for the moment. The exploitation phase is clearly just beginning.
Do you care to reply to that, Dr. Strangway, or can we ask for questions?
Well, I can see questions coming up, so let's do questions.
Yes, go ahead.
I was thinking, actually, I didn't want to appear here. I was here once before this week, and that was enough. And because I think there's a kind of a disservice to keep appearing and not have other people have their say. I remembered Apollo 11. And I remembered Apollo 11 that there were a bunch of old fatheads up there who hadn't changed their minds or come up with any recognition of real ideas or recognition of the facts. Now we're at Apollo 17, and this is an equally momentous occasion, and you may again be looking at the next generation of fatheads. And the actual answers may be outside that door.
For yourself.
I am.
We have questions?
Dr. Walker, what is this the interstellar matter that is interacting with the Strangway's solar gases that prevent a magnetic field from occurring, or what?
Oh, no. On Earth, you have a magnetic field, right? Go take a cosmic ray detector to the equator and make a measurement. Carry it up to the North Pole and make another measurement. There's a big difference, okay? This is how cosmic rays were established as being cosmic rays back in the 1930s. The fact is that at the equator, because you have a magnetic field that's this way, the particles can't cross it, okay? Whereas the North Pole, they can come in along the field lines and they get in, okay? Now, I must admit that in my criticism of Strangway's idea, which may turn out to be right, I have made an implicit assumption that the moon's magnetic field was north-south. That's not necessarily right, obviously. And right.
They made no statements about the orientation.
Yeah. Right.
And the other assumption, Bob, was that the materials you're talking about are trapped solar winds in the breccias.
And I'm talking about low-energy solar flare particles, in which you can see the actual tracks and where the energy spectra extend down to very low energies, but still enough to be affected by those gammas. No, the point is the following, okay? So if you had a magnetic field, and if it were oriented the way I assumed it was, okay, then these things from the sun would have been turned away. But in fact, when you look at the old samples, you see these effects of the sun directly, okay? But maybe the magnetic field was tilted, and so I'm willing to leave the question open.
But isn't Strangway talking about perhaps different conditions existing then, that you had still the solar nebula existing, and so wouldn't that change?
No, I don't think Strangway, I don't know, I should let Strangway speak for himself, but I don't think Strangway wants a solar nebula 3.9 billion years ago still to be in existence. What he wants is a permanent magnet, the moon to be a permanent magnet that length of time ago. The solar nebula presumably has long since dissipated.
And what he's saying basically is if there's a magnetic field, a permanent magnet of that kind, it will stand off and generate an ionosphere, which will protect these particles from getting in. But I think there is the question of the poles and the complexities and variations. It's not clear to me that it has to.
Well, that's what I meant when I said the exploitation phase. What are the consequences of your model?
Right.
How can we test it by looking at samples taken from different latitude that we now have? And what are the measurements we should make? Well, He's stirred up now us to prove that he's wrong if we can. Okay?
It's good.
Could someone say something about, well, I'll ask this question. Does it appear that the moon is different laterally? I mean, I know Dr. Wood was talking about the asymmetry of certain, of other aspects, geophysical. Does it look like it's different chemically? I know I keep hearing the comparisons between the Apollo 17 and Apollo 11 basalts and material. Could it be that one side of the moon, the stuff that came out on one side of the moon is different than the stuff that came to the surface on the other side of the moon?
I didn't hear Tromka's talk on Monday, but I think I know some of the results. And I think, the first order answer to your question, Everly, is that the moon on the average, you can take, a hemisphere of the moon and take the average composition of that hemisphere and compare it to the average composition of another hemisphere and get a highly significant difference in chemical composition whether you choose, let's say, aluminum concentration, magnesium concentration, potassium or uranium or thorium. so that the moon is, in a sense, asymmetric. In a sense, we've also known that ever since the Russians flew around the backside, because we knew there weren't very Mari regions on the backside. We've made it more quantitative now, in the sense that we've tied this asymmetry down to chemistry. It, however, is not, I think, fair to say today that there is, for example, if you take crete basalt, of which there is a lot in the west, is it the western or western front side of the moon, if they associate that with the high radioactivity, that there is no crete basalt on the backside. You have to take the limits of the chemistry and ask yourself, what are the limits? If they say is 80% of the upper part of the regolith in certain selected parts of the moon may consist of crete basalt, I doubt there is very many places where you can say that there is less than 10%. So you're talking about a factor of probably 5 to 10 in the degree of asymmetry for that particular element.
Would you please wait for the microphone?
Differences between the eastern and western Mari as far as our the materials, as far as what we've seen?
That's a very subtle question, and I think, you know, that whether or not the differences that you measure in the surface chemistry as revealed by the X-ray fluorescence experiment and the gamma ray experiment are really differences in the Mari or are differences in the overlying regolith, which are not controlled by the Mari but are controlled by long-distance ejecta thrown out over long distances, is probably, in my mind at least, is an open question. Because the Mari rocks that we have from Apollo 12, which, if they're typical, are really no different than the Apollo 15 rocks.
Should be pointed out, too, I think, that while there's clear asymmetry at the surface, no one knows whether the moon is asymmetric if you were to drive a core all the way from the surface to the center in several places and take the average for that core. And that's, of course, an important question to try to determine, because it has a lot to do both with the present structure of the moon and the way in which it may have accreted.
Dr. Haskin, you said there were a number of analogies popping up between the early history of the moon and the early history of the Earth. Could you go into those, please?
I was afraid you'd ask that. First of all, I said that more because I think it's a state of mind that people are heading for. They're thinking more about things that happened early in the Earth and early in the moon. The one naturally that comes to my mind is the one that I was involved with in this particular conference, so I'll just comment on what it is. We were trying to understand why, if the samarium to europium ratio for the moon as a whole is the same as the samarium europium ratio in the chondritic meteorites, which we take as an estimate of solar material, why every time we look at a lunar soil we find a negative europium anomaly, with only one exception that I know of. Because presumably we should have the europium anomalies balance out. And because of this, we ended up assuming that perhaps liquids had penetrated somewhat later than the establishment of most of the crust above the surface, and that these liquids, being residues from the crystallization of lots of plagioclase, would give a negative europium anomaly to some sort of surface veneer. But we also found a few years ago that the relative abundance of europium compared with samarium on Earth seems to have decreased, according to the record in ancient sedimentary rocks, from the chondritic value or higher about 3 to 3.5 billion years ago down to the present level found in practically all common types of sediments of Paleozoic age or younger. And we tried hard to explain that, not very successfully, but it seems possible that that relatively high europium value might be a sort of analogous thing to what we were thinking about for the moon, that perhaps the Earth's crust originally had much more anorthosite than it presently does, and that with time this has been weathered away and also covered up with younger material that's come out on top of it.
Would you please wait for the microphone?
Is that limited to one analogy, or do you have other?
I think I can add one to that. Recently, in studying a very old Precambrian areas in Earth in South Africa and in Canada, people have uncovered a type of rock which has a name, comatite, which is a very magnesium-rich, an olivine-rich lava flow, and has some parallels with the Mare basalts, magnesium-rich Mare basalts. And there's actually a paper in the literature in one of the scientific journals where someone proposed that these magnesium-rich rocks found in, I think, three continents, Australia, Africa, and Canada, were produced by a very large impact on Earth before 3.3 billion years ago, much in the way, or some way are associated with a large impact, much in the way that they are in the Mare Basin on the surface of the moon. It's highly speculative kind of explanation, but I doubt whether anybody would have proposed that hadn't they seen the stuff on the moon and had the parallel to go by. Just time will tell whether more of these kind of parallels between early terrestrial history and lunar history will show up. I mean, there are similar sort of things that people are now studying terrestrial anorthosites, early anorthosites, in great detail, and trying to find out whether there's any parallelism between the chemistry of these very old anorthosites on Earth and those on the moon, and maybe the Earth, some people are speculating, had an anorthositic crust when it first began, something like the moon we know has today. Very, I mean, this is real speculation, but nevertheless, it's respectable enough speculation so that it is being written in scientific literature. It's not just cocktail party talk.
There is another one that I thought of, which is perhaps even more important, and that is that the Earth's atmosphere and the oceans and a number of elements which are relatively volatile are thought to be present at the surface as a result of volcanic activity. And these elements seem to be far less apparently depleted in the highland regions than they are in the Mare regions. Perhaps this tells us something about the presence of volatiles with the earliest rocks formed as opposed to somewhat later magmas or lavas.
Dr. Gast, you mentioned the figure 3.8 billion years ago, a while ago, when you were speaking of the orange soil. Is that the accepted age of the orange soil? And could you speculate a little bit about how the orange soil got there?
I can't. I'll give you a speculation. The number I picked was out of a hat. I think maybe the more correct number is, if you take all the numbers that were reported this afternoon, the lowest one was, I think, around 3.69, and the highest one may have been around 3.79 or 3.8. So I probably should have said 3.75. So if you want to, you know, be sure of the third figure in that thing, I haven't done the averaging, you know, and decided whether, you know, what's accepted or what's not accepted. Something in that vicinity. The errors are high enough to cover the difference between that range. You know, everybody here, I'm sure, has a certain speculation of the origin of the orange soil. My sort of top of the head speculation is that the orange soil represents a layer of material that is intercalated, to use a geological word, with the lava flows underneath the valleys, perhaps not uniformly over the whole valley, which was brought up where one of the craters penetrated through a thin lava flow and brought up on the surface 8 million years ago. That's a very simple-minded sort of thing, but it had to be there that long, about the same time as the basalts. If it was a pyroclastic type rock, it probably occurred in at least a local layer of some sort, and we somehow or another brought that layer to the surface by an impact 8 million years ago. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, Lee, because I think that's a
sort of well, almost made up on the spot.
I think that's a pretty good one. My own little building model is very similar. We've seen two groups of age data, and it's worthwhile comparing them. The orange soil data has run, as Paul said, from a little under 3.7 to almost 3.8. There's been a surprising agreement on the basalt data on two different basalt samples at very, very close to 3.8. In fact, a number like 3.82 kept popping in surprisingly over and over again. Analytically, I would say that, in fact, I'd say as a compliment to my colleagues in the argon and rubidium strontium business, is that this is the best display of interlaboratory correlation I've ever seen by it. It's outstanding, fantastic. I don't believe it, but that's beside the point. Fantastic precision. I think I'd rather press on the similarity than on the differences, although the differences may ultimately turn out to be significant. The fact is that these glasses seem to be very closely associated with the basaltic activity in terms of age. They are different in chemistry, and all kinds of data suggest that they've had very little solar exposure. So one looks for a way for making these things in a surface environment, because they had to be quenched relatively quickly, and then burying them very quickly so that they could not accumulate the effects of surface exposure, and holding them buried until they were revealed, as Paul said, by the impact which produced the Shorty crater. Now, the 8-million-year age isn't the one I'd heard, Paul, but I don't know.
Well, it ranged from 8 to 30 or something.
8 to 30 was the number I'd heard.
The youngest one is 8, and the oldest one is probably 30.
Something I heard. So my thinking has gone just like Paul's.
All I suggested is that if you had to bury it, one way of burying it is to have a thin lava flow come in after it was deposited and covered it.
Dr. Strangeway, could you explain the implications of magnetite in the soil and how this fits in?
I'm not sure I know what all the implications of that are. The presence of magnetite has been sporadically reported earlier by a couple of other investigators. I think perhaps this is the clearest evidence that we have that there is some magnetite in some lunar material. What it suggests is very much the same kind of thing, I think, as the presence of the girthite or the rusty rock presented, is that at least some small amounts of material were formed in an oxidizing environment. I don't think it says necessarily that it's volcanic, non-volcanic. I don't think it tells you very much of that sort of thing. I think what it does simply is to tell you that there was another source of material here which formed in an oxidizing environment, and that could be a very local thing. It could be preserved, trapped into the glass particles. I'm not sure where in that material those things are. But
suggested on a rusty rock that a comet might have been involved. Is it?
That which?
A comet might have been involved.
Well, that has been suggested. I think we really ought to defer to our comet expert in the middle over here, Paul Gast.
I think, though, that to try to associate the magnetite, which is extremely finely dispersed in the glass, with macroscopic or at least submacroscopic gaithite in rusty rock is a big jump. I mean, they may have two totally different stories involved in it. If this really was all glass to begin with, the magnetite almost surely has to originate from the de-vitrification of the glass in some way.
We'll take one final question.
Just a little bit. That's because the site where the orange soil was collected is turning out to be tremendously interesting. The drive tube that went down into the orange soil passed through it and went into a zone of black material, black shiny material. As a matter of fact, Schmidt said it looks like magnetite.
I know he did. I didn't
know that. They said it on section.
You did, Lee.
But what I'm trying to say is that if you look at the orange soil population, while it's largely orange, it also contains quite a few dark particles that may be closely related to the high concentration of dark particles that are deeper down in the tube. And Dave was measuring the cumulative qualities, the total qualities of this bulk of this material, and it's not yet clear whether the magnetite he's seeing is actually in the orange glass or in a smaller fraction of the population, which may be more like the deeper part of the core. Until we get that measurement made, we won't know for sure, right, Dave?
Right. My request to LESAP is going to include a piece of that.
Okay. There was another very exciting presentation made, which bears directly on the orange soil, and that had to do with the absorption spectra, and this was reported by Dr. Bell from the Carnegie Institution, in which he said that he thought he could definitely see evidence of titanium plus 3 in a very marked way. And that was in the orange glass as opposed to the total sample. Now, titanium plus 3 represents a state of reduction that's not compatible with the presence of magnetite. So we probably have some mechanical mixture in there. That doesn't make either of them wrong. It just says that you have to separate the phases in which they're associated.
Last question.
Dr. Gass, getting back to the lunar terrestrial parallel, is it possible or conceivable that the Earth underwent some kind of a series of cataclysmic events around 4.0 billion years too?
Well, I'm not a celestial mechanician, and the people who do the mechanics on this, I think, have different opinions. But a simple-minded sort of thing certainly says, you know, if the Earth and the Moon were as close together then as they are now, you had large bodies falling around, falling on one of them, why weren't there large bodies falling on the other one? We've always said this ever since, you know, Apollo 14, I think, when we first emphasized or zeroed in on the Imbrium impact. There are probably ways in which you could protect the Earth from this, but it is rather interesting, you know, that the Earth history prior to 3.9 billion years is also pretty well wiped out. We have very little evidence of what happened on Earth much before 3.8 billion years. And it's certainly a reasonable speculation to say that some of these major impacts, if they hit the Earth, you know, could have disrupted the Earth's atmosphere and the oceans and all sorts of things. And that one of the reasons we have had difficulty finding rocks on Earth that are older than 3.8 billion years is maybe the same reason we have difficulty finding rocks that are older than that on the Moon.
I know several specific individuals who are now re-looking at the geological maps of Precambrian crusts in different parts of the world, and it's long been known that continents build out of continental nuclei, which have varying ages and so on, and there are people now seriously speculating, and this is almost cocktail-type conversation as opposed to in paper yet, but they're certainly seriously speculating whether some of these early, very ancient continental structures did not originate from this kind of a triggering mechanism, and perhaps even some of the backbones of some of the continents were triggered in this kind of way. This is particularly true in the Precambrian Shield. You see these great, beautiful circular structures. You know, right? There's a very...
I'm sorry to have to cut it off now, but we do have the science pilots immediately following, so thank you all, gentlemen.